On this week's 51%, we speak with sports law professor Dion Kohler about the benefits and risks of youth sports and what parents should know before signing their kids up.
It's evolving in a direction of becoming more and more competitive, more and more expensive, and this is what we refer to as the professionalization of youth sport.
We also stop by a roller derby bout in New York's Hudson Valley. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Our main guest today has been focusing on the state of youth sports and the lack of regulation around it. Now, I should probably preface this by acknowledging that there's a lot of uproar and debate right now over the inclusion of transgender girls in girls' sports, especially as the Trump administration moves to restrict the transgender community. And just to be clear, that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about when we talk about protecting girls' sports today are regulations to ensure physical safety, prevent concussions, safeguard girls from potentially abusive situations, and make sports more accessible. Our main guest today says these kinds of regulations should be talked about more because they don't really exist once you start talking about more privatized sports programs, and when they do, they're pretty lackluster. Dion Kohler is a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, whose research has focused on sports law. A former child athlete herself and a mother to youth athletes, Kohler says she wanted to better understand how youth sports got to where they are today. She says they're becoming more private, like year-round club sports, more expensive, more time-consuming, and more focused on churning out elite athletes than having fun, building character, or staying active. While she still sees a lot of benefits to youth sports, Kohler says the lack of regulation around it is holding kids back. Her new book on the subject is More Than Play: How Law, Policy, and Politics Shape American Youth Sport.
In order to understand the law and policy around youth sports, I had to really go into the history. Organized adult-led youth sports have kind of been a thing in this country since at least the progressive era, since the early 1900s. And going all the way back to that time, you can find concerns that it was becoming more about the adults and a little too competitive and a little too intense for kids' kind of minds and bodies for where they are in their developmental stages. And so what's happened is that the law and policy around youth sports has never really stepped in to regulate. So even though there's been this notion for really decades that we need to at least have some minimum safety standards, or the American Academy of Pediatrics putting out statements, many statements about concerns about tackle football, for instance. Really, government has not sought to do anything in terms of minimum guarantees of safety, any other types of regulations that would address some of the issues that we've seen. So from a law and policy perspective, what's really happened is that government has stayed on the sidelines for the most part of youth sport, based on the assumption that this is just a good, healthy thing for kids. And of course, we know it is. It is in many, many ways. Giving kids exercise and fun with friends and skill building can be just a fantastic experience. But what we see is that this preference by the government to stay out of youth sports, and really, as I talk about in the book, to stay out of all of sports, has led the system to kind of go unchecked and continue growing in one direction. And the primary law and policy kind of effect on youth sports is this notion of parental authority, that parents are in a position to decide. And of course, parents are in many ways in a great position to decide what to do with their kids in terms of how to raise them, but they might not be in the best position to understand whether their child has, say, suffered a concussion in a youth hockey game. And so there's really a gap there in our law and policy understanding that I wanted to write about.
And so what has that lack of regulation helped to create? You know, I know you touched on it already, but what is the youth sports industry of today like? What are kids and parents out there facing?
It is a multi-billion-dollar business. The youth sports industry is thriving and it's huge. And so, when I talk about kind of how youth sports is evolving in the book, it's evolving in a direction of becoming more and more competitive, more and more expensive, more and more sort of year-round sports specialization by children. And this is what we refer to as the professionalization of youth sports. So when we think about historically youth sports, it used to be kids would go out and play and organize their own baseball games or pick up soccer games or a pickup basketball game. This is very far from that. This is adult-led, highly organized. And there are some real benefits to that, of course. Kids can get good at a sport really young and really early. And of course, we know for a small subset of kids, they go on to be elite athletes. And that can be really terrific for them and for their future prospects. But for the millions and millions of kids who get involved, what we also know is that continuing to professionalize, so to speak, youth sports by emphasizing year-round training and skill building, it can be a little too much developmentally for their minds and bodies. The medical community has been talking for years about an epidemic of preventable youth sport injuries from overtraining. And the other thing is that it becomes very costly, so that so many kids can't even get involved in youth sports anymore because it's privatized and it's costly and expensive with all the travel and the competition. So whereas we might have had, say, 40 years ago, even 30 years ago, more publicly subsidized kind of local rec leagues, those are disappearing very, very fast. And so it's becoming a very expensive industry.
I mean, if your goal is to get like an athletic scholarship or to become an elite athlete when you grow up, you know, is it possible to still do that without getting sucked into the private, professionalized youth sports of today? I guess the old-fashioned way.
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, that's what many professional athletes and sports medicine professionals recommend is be a multi-sport athlete, play a lot of different sports, and don't hyper-specialize, because what we also know from the data is that kids who try to go out there and be an elite athlete and parents who push them in that direction in our kind of prevailing model for hyper-competitive sports specialized youth sports, kids burn out and they end up quitting most of the time by the time they hit age 13. And so they're not staying with sports to become the next great elite athlete because they're burned out, because they've suffered career-ending injuries or overtraining injuries. And so the best way actually to be, and what we know that, and parents still refuse to believe it, is the best way to go ahead and become an elite athlete can be just having fun, participating in a range of sports, and letting kids' minds and bodies grow up.
Your book touches on a term you call sports parenting. Tell me a little bit more about that. I think a lot of us maybe have an idea of what that might look like in our minds, the way youth sports can become all-consuming as a parent, but what is sports parenting?
Yeah, it really is. I was very struck when I was doing research for the book to see that the psychological community has done real work in this area and has identified this notion of sport parenting. I think we all kind of intuitively know it, and certainly in the popular media, a lot has been written about this, right? It's the parents who just lose their sense of distance and focus. You know, they're screaming at the refs, they're yelling at other parents, they're yelling at their own kid or other kids. That's an extreme form of sport parenting. But what the literature talks about is it's really sort of a psychological phenomenon. And I know I've experienced it myself. It feels really good to sit and watch your kid on the weekend go score a goal in a hockey game or do well in a gymnastics meet or do their best in a swim meet. It feels good. And it becomes sort of a feedback loop where you see your child excelling at sports. And that's feedback for the parent that says, hey, I'm a good parent. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing because everybody says that youth sport is part of a good childhood. So if my kid's out there doing well in sports, I'm doing well as a parent. And what we know is that it can go from that kind of relatively benign level to kind of easily slide into parents overly identifying with their children's athletic success, so that the parent really wants it more than the child. And that's where things really get to be problematic.
What kinds of situations and power dynamics do you see families having to navigate once they enter that world of youth sports?
Well, there are lots of power dynamics in youth sports, and I sort of unpack this because I say the child sits at the bottom of a couple different hierarchies when they're participating in youth sports. There's, of course, the parent-child hierarchy, and there's very good reasons for that. Parents are the adults in the room, literally, and parents do need to have authority over their children, surely. But the child is also at the bottom of the hierarchy in terms of the coach-athlete hierarchy, so the sports hierarchy. And we know in this country that children as children have very few rights. Children as athletes and athletes in general have very few rights. And so what I talk about in the book is that because there are these power dynamics, really one of the only sources of power that children have is to quit sports altogether if they feel that their needs aren't being responded to, or there's too much pressure, or their bodies can't do it anymore. And so I talk about rethinking that, and look at other countries, for instance, that have emphasized some rights for children around sports, rights to choose how much they compete, and to be able to pull back if they feel that their bodies are hurting or they aren't having fun and the like. So there are other ways to do youth sports. We just don't in this country, mostly have those conversations.
You mentioned that the government hasn't really stepped in with much regulation and that not wanting to step on parental authority plays a role in that. But, you also said that sports in general aren't really regulated in the US. Why is that, and what would you like to see?
Yeah, I and one of the things I talk about in the book as well is that the idea of regulation can be certainly for some political beliefs, it can be a dirty word just as a whole, but especially in sports, the idea is you can't regulate, and I see this over and over, and I've actually written about this, the idea that if you impose any liability on sports providers, it will ruin the games, that if you have any minimum level of regulation, it will ruin all of sports. We're seeing this now at the NCAA level, right? Athletes are getting some rights that they haven't had before, and the NCAA and others are saying this is going to ruin all of college sports. History shows us that when we do a little bit of regulation in sports, it doesn't ruin anything. It actually makes it a lot better. And what I talk about in the book is, for instance, we could very easily do bare minimum safety regulations for athletes, for children who are involved in sports. There's so many products that touch children that we regulate every day, and parents assume they are, that there are minimum safety standards. And it is hard for me when I talk to parent groups, for instance, about youth sports, and they say, isn't somebody requiring a background check on the coach who's coaching my kid? Especially after the Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics fallout, the sex abuse scandal, people say, isn't somebody looking at these folks? And the answer is there's very little minimum safety regulation. So what I would love to see is just some minimum safety standards, akin to what we do with anything from a crib to a car seat to other products that touch children's minds and bodies. I don't think in any way it would ruin sports, but it would give parents peace of mind, and it could absolutely improve the experience for kids.
So what's the benefit of what we have right now? Who's actually benefiting from our current setup?
Well, it's very clear who benefits from the way things are structured right now, and that is the sports industry, right? Anybody who's sponsoring a youth sports program, the sports industry itself, always benefits when there's no regulation because they don't have to do those background checks on coaches if they don't want to, or they don't have to have coach certifications. They don't have to spend money to sort of make things safer and run their programs in a slightly different way. I will say there are many youth sports programs that do want to run their programs that way, and there are many sort of attempts in various places to make it better. So when I talk about regulation, I'm talking about kind of a bare minimum for every child in the United States, not for a child who's lucky enough to participate with, say, a provider that wants to do those things. So who benefits is the youth sport industry, and who comes out on the losing end? Well, any kid who say suffers a concussion in sports and nobody realizes it, and that child suffers long-term injury as a result. Any child who comes into contact with a coach or someone else who has an abuse background. This is not rampant in youth sports, we know, and I don't want to be alarmist. We know there are so many good things that happen in youth sports, but we could do more to engage with the experience kids are having to improve that experience and sort of guarantee to the best we can a better, safer experience for every kid and not just the ones who are lucky enough to have programs that prioritize those things.
Are there any ways you see this particularly impacts girls in sports?
Yeah, I think there's lots of ways, and I talk about this in the book as well. There's lots of ways that I think girls, female athletes are impacted by our current approach to youth sports. One of those ways is that most youth sport coaches are men. They're mostly dads. They're upper middle class white males, and they can be fantastic. Again, my kids have had fantastic coaches, but we don't have a lot of women in coaching in general in sports. And just having some variety and role modeling around that can be really beneficial for girls who are coming up as athletes. In addition, we know that Title IX, the law that guarantees gender equality in high school and college sports, it's never really been fully enforced. And we need to do more to sort of guarantee that girls are getting the participation opportunities that they're entitled to in a wide, wide range of sports. And so there are lots of ways that our girls are still not getting what they need to be getting out of sports. It's certainly better than it was, say, 50 years ago. But we need to look to do much, much more.
Well, Dion, thank you so much for taking the time. Is there anything that we haven't touched on yet that you want to make sure people know?
Well, I don't think so. You asked great questions, and you asked the questions that a lot of parents are talking about right now. What I would say is people should just be engaged in these conversations. I think too often we take sports for granted and think, well, this is just the way it's supposed to be. And that's not the case as well. Talk to your legislators, talk to your coaches, talk to anybody who's interested in youth sports, because there's a lot of room for making things better and more responsive to our kids.
Dion Kohler is professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, specializing in sports law. Her new book is More Than Play, How Law, Policy, and Politics Shape American Youth Sport. It's out now at most major booksellers. Here at 51%, we love a good roller derby bout. Recently in New York's Hudson Valley, the Mid-Hudson Misfits kicked off their season with a charity scrimmage benefiting a local LGBTQ+ community center. Mid-Hudson Misfits provides an open and inclusive space for women in the region who want to learn and play flat track roller derby. Kimberly Izar with the New York Public News Network sent us this report from Skate Time in Accord.
We have help no pity!
Two teams gather on the side of the oval-shaped roller rink. That's the countdown just before the scrimmage at Skate Time begins. Welcome to Roller Derby with the Mid-Hudson Misfits Roller Derby team. Roller derby is a full-contact sport, so expect skaters to use their whole bodies to score points.
This form of derby looks a lot like a demolition derby with cars. There's two sets of five players on the track at one time. One of those players is the jammer. They'll have the star in the helmet. The jammer is the person who can score points, and they score points by getting through the pack of blockers, who are the other players, first, and then lapping that pack. And whichever jammer gets through first is the lead jammer. And the benefit of being the lead jammer is you can call off the jam at any point.
That's Patine Riot explaining how the game works. Yes, that's their roller derby name, a nickname skaters choose to reflect their personality. Roller derby is one of those games you really have to see in person. It's been around since the 1930s. It started in Chicago by Leo Seltzer, and since then, it's grown into a beloved pastime and sport by communities traditionally marginalized from mainstream sports, specifically queer people, women, and Black and Latino communities. At the Mid-Hudson Misfit Scrimmage, you can find skaters embracing their whole selves and quite literally using their bodies to ram into each other. Tonight is a charity scrimmage. The teams are raising funds for the Hudson Valley LGBTQ Plus Center in Kingston, which provides services and programming for the LGBTQ Plus community in the region. For new skater Fennec Fox, who's competing for the first time, roller derby has meant finding an inclusive community.
So I identify as transmasculine, right? I've never felt weird about it, you know, because sometimes it's hard being, I'm comfortable being around women and feminine people, but it's weird being around cisgender women in like sports. You know, it's a controversial topic right now, but I really feel at home in derby, and it's really great to both be active and like have these people as a community to me.
With the Mid-Hudson Misfits, roller derby is for everyone, and they're training the next generation of skaters. They have a juniors team called the Mid-Hudson Mischiefs for all genders ages 9 to 17. At the scrimmage, junior skater Layla Lagosi shares how she came up with her derby name and what's next for her.
So Bela Lugosi played Dracula in the first Dracula movie. So I replaced Bella with Lela.
And have you been able to make a lot of friends?
Yeah.
Do you think you're going to be doing this for a long time?
Definitely.
In Accord, I'm Kimberly Izar for the New York Public News Network.
We're going to switch gears a little bit before we go. As I mentioned earlier in the show, the Trump administration has targeted the LGBTQ plus community in several of its executive orders, specifically the transgender community. At a recent Equality for All forum in Western Massachusetts, State Attorney General Andrea Campbell and others described the fallout of these actions and what's being done in response. WAMC's James Palialagopoulos reports.
The landscape of the laws here, which at moments are more protective than the federal landscape, still exists in Massachusetts. So as hard as it may be, it's still a blessing to be here because of the rights that are afforded us in this community. And I'm thank you.
Speaking to a room filled with advocates and elected officials Tuesday, Campbell emphasized that amid a flurry of executive orders from President Donald Trump, civil rights protections and laws in Massachusetts still stand, despite changing federal policies. It was part of the focus of a Equality for All forum, co-sponsored by the Attorney General's Office and Western New England University's Center for Social Justice. The event in Springfield featured Campbell, as well as Tanya Neslusen, Executive Director of Mass Equality, an organization devoted to fighting discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and more. Neslusen says a number of vulnerable populations are feeling panic as what amounts to fear-mongering at a national level continues to play out.
That's exactly what it is fear-mongering with these executive orders. They don't do anything in a vacuum. You need to change federal policy. But beyond that, we have protections in Massachusetts. We have laws in Massachusetts that protect our folks. Where I'm really seeing the concern are the ways in which these things may be able to impact us. And a lot of that is tied to what if the government cuts off funding? What if government cuts off funding to our hospitals, to our schools?
Up for discussion were the multiple actions taken by the Trump administration involving the LGBTQ plus community and others, from threatening to withhold federal funding over DEI initiatives to attempts to bar trans women from taking part in women's sports to moving trans women inmates from women's prisons to men's facilities. WNE law professor Jennifer Levi moderated the discussion. Also working as the senior director of transgender and queer rights for GLAAD, Levi added that some executive orders did not come as a total shock, such as an executive order seeking to ban trans people from serving in the military, but the extent of the vitriol accompanying them was something else.
It's really alarming, and folks that I work with know I've spent a lot of time in D.C. the last couple months, and to have the lawyer for the government to stand up and admit, of course, that there's no basis for characterizing an entire group of people who have met conditions of service and put their lives on the front line for a decade and more, and to call them liars and undisciplined and dishonest is shocking and alarming.
Levi took part in legal actions against Trump during his first term and is a part of other efforts in his second as well, including one that secured an injunction on the most recent transgender military ban attempt. Speaking of injunctions, Campbell and her office have been part of multiple lawsuits challenging presidential orders, joining with other Democratic state attorneys general in the process. Efforts so far have included getting a court order to block a federal funding freeze implemented early on in the Trump administration. The AG, along with others at the forum, described how, regardless of executive orders, civil rights protections remain, and that amid of what seems to be widespread confusion, a need is emerging to simply address the public and say said protections still exist.
Nothing has changed in terms of the civil protections that are afforded folks in this community, as vast and diverse as it is in Massachusetts. Nothing. It is fear-mongering, it is targeting, and being strategic, of course, as well. But we have to continue to actually go to places to stress that, because people think things have changed, that their civil rights have been thrown out the window, and they no longer have protections in their schools. They no longer have protections in terms of access to health care. They no longer are protected in terms of discrimination of the job or other places. You are in Massachusetts. You have a right to gender-affirming care here in Massachusetts because of folks sitting in the front. We are updating our SHIELD law to protect our providers in terms of data privacy and sharing of information. The SHIELD law is still here.
Reporting from Springfield, this is James Polyoligopoulos at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete, sweet melting little girl dreams. They said, oh, take it.